From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Flannery O'Connor was diagnosed with lupus at age 26, given 5 years to live. She lived to 39, a Catholic-raised daughter of Georgia, writing some of the most important novels and short stories in the American canon. They could be dark, hard stories. Now, a recently discovered prayer journal of Flannery O'Connor opens a new window on the artist as a young woman, earnestly beseeching the divine to let her be great. This hour on Point, the newly discovered prayer journal of Flannery O'Connor. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you hear in this voice of Flannery O'Connor? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We do not have the sound of her voice reading from this journal, but she thought and wrote and spoke plenty about the place of religion and faith in her time. Here's an undated archival recording of Flannery O'Connor. She reads an early version of her essay, Some Aspects of the Grotesque in Southern Fiction, in which she discusses God and the South.
I think it's quite safe to say that while the South is hardly Christ-centered, it is most certainly Christ-hearted. The Southerner who isn't convinced of it is very much afraid that he may have been formed in the image and likeness of God. And ghosts can be very fierce and instructive. They cast strange shadows, particularly in our literature.
Ghosts can be very fierce and instructive. They cast strange shadows, particularly in our literature. The voice there of Flannery O'Connor. Her new prayer journal takes us into a young time in her life. Joining me now from Atlanta is Georgia, is W.A. Sessions, poet, playwright, biographer, scholar, a personal friend of Flannery O'Connor, professor of English emeritus at Georgia State University. He's written biographies on poet Henry Howard, Sir Francis Bacon, and is at work on a biography of Flannery O'Connor. He's editor of the newly uncovered work from O'Connor titled A Prayer Journal. W.A. Sessions, Bill Sessions, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
So nice to have you here. And in New York, Paul Eli joins us, writer, editor, scholar of Flannery O'Connor, senior fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University, author of Reinventing Bach and The Life You Save May Be Your Own, a biography of four modern Catholics, including Flannery O'Connor, Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day, and Walker Percy. Paul Eli, welcome to you as well. So great to have you here.
Glad to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Bill Sessions, please just tell us the story of this journal, when it was written, what's in it overall, and when and how was it found?
Well, the journal was written in Iowa when she was 21 and 22 years old. She had finished GSCW, Georgia State College for Women, right there in Milledgeville, her home. And so she went away to school to work in the Paul Ingalls Writer's Workshop. Well, that led to many other areas, but in the process of learning how to write, she began to examine herself in a new environment, a new place with new ideas, and that, I think, is what this book is about, and I think that attributes its success to the fact that it has that voice of searching, of looking, of trying to find realities, and she has the language for it. So I myself was asked by the estate to write a biography of Flannery O'Connor, and so as I went through the papers, all tabulated and worked out well, but I discovered over in a corner of one area, a journal, and this was what I discovered. It was this one we have right here, and I looked at it and was really amazed. First of all, other people hadn't found it before now, and then secondly, that of what it had. So I proceeded to hold on to it, look at it. I read it at a conference in Chicago at Loyola, and it had a success, and from there, it made its way to Farrar Charu, where it is being published, I understand, today. So I feel I've been very lucky in handling this, but I do think it's quintessentially a work of Flannery O'Connor's, and it has some of the same dynamic and irony and paradox that I think everybody likes in her work. And I think that's the first thing a reader will find is the dynamic going on, reading, and it will take you as far as you want to go.
Now, this was written by hand, in her hand, kind of a school notebook, more or less.
That's right, yeah. It was a Sterling handbook you got at any bookstore in those days, college bookstore. And I know she intended to do something with it because in my research, I found out that when she sent her manuscripts from Iowa before she went to Yaddo, where she would meet Robert Lowell and all the others, she packed it carefully among her clothes and told a friend, look after this, she said, and then I'll take it back to Georgia. And so it was sent back, and there it stayed from 1948 until I discovered it, it was kept there till I found it, I should say, and found it to have the quality it had. It was really remarkable finding this, and I think it will help a great many O'Connor people, and that's the whole point, is to help the O'Connor readers, the aficionados, those who really want to get involved and want a little more than Wikipedia on Flannery.
Paul, Eli, help us here with a little reading, if you'd be good enough. For those who haven't seen a bit of this journal, just to get its flavor, how earnest, how beseeching, how open, how vulnerable she makes herself here. There's a bit where she asks if anyone can teach her how to pray, but throughout this journal, you get the sense that she's very familiar with prayer and exercising it in a quite writerly and wonderful, youthful way here herself.
Well, this is a passage from relatively early in the journal. And as Bill says, the searching voice is here. Mm-hmm. Flannery O'Connor, who in our encounters with her in her letters and essays seems to know so much so surely, is still at a point where she doesn't yet know. So she asks, and I'll begin reading, mm-hmm. How can I live? How shall I live? Obviously, the only way to live right is to give up everything. But I have no vocation, and maybe that is wrong anyway. But how to eliminate this picky fishbone kind of way I do things? I want so to love God all the way. At the same time, I want all the things that seem opposed to it. I want to be a fine writer. Any success will tend to swell my head, unconsciously even. If I ever do get to be a fine writer, will not be because I am a fine writer, but because God has given me credit for a few of the things he kindly wrote for me. Right at present, this does not seem to be his policy. I can't write a thing, but I'll continue to try. That is the point. And at every dry point, I will be reminded who is doing the work when it is done, and who is not doing it at that moment. Right now, I wonder if God will ever do any more writing for me. He has promised his grace. I'm not so sure about the other. Perhaps I've not been thankful enough for what has gone before. The desires of the flesh, excluding the stomach, have been taken away from me. For how long, I don't know, but I hope forever. It is a great peace to be rid of them. Can't anyone teach me how to pray?
Paul Eli reading and wonderfully from Flannery O'Connor's Prayer Journal. What is the perspective on faith, on religion that we get here that has maybe quite different by the time we come to her mature works, Paul?
Well, there's a lot to be said about this journal, but two things in particular strike me. As Bill says, it's from 1946 and 1947, and most of us who know her fiction, beginning with Wise Blood, published in 52, her letters, mainly written from the early 50s onward, and her essays from the late 50s, know a person who's astonishingly assured and knows exactly what she thinks to the point where she's almost intimidating to some of the recipients of her letters, and also a person who has been marked by the experience of mortal illness, lupus. Mm-hmm. She has a very dark view of reality, and she connects it, frankly, to being sick. I have never been anywhere other than but sick, she says, or something to that effect at one point. So to see this journalist to suddenly get a glimpse of O'Connor before she was sick and before she knew everything. We can feel her figuring things out, and we can feel her figuring things out without the heavy hand of illness on her.
and with an earnestness, Bill Sessions. I mean, we think of her later, the faith is always there somehow, and yet it can be so dry, and it can be so, her whole view can be so sarcastic here. It's just absolutely the dew of youth is on these entries.
I think so. I think also in there, though, that you begin to get the sense of the irony and the paradox that she finds in all of life. That is, she's finding, for example, she has a very interesting passage on how to write a novel. To maintain any thread in the novel, there must be a view of the world behind it. And the most important single item under the view of the world is conception of love, divine, natural, and perverted. It is probably possible to say that when a view of the world is present, a broad enough view, no more need be added to make the world view. And then she goes into discussing Freud, Proust, Lawrence, and all of this, which is a very objective and certainly mature development. And that, I think, is something the book has, a sophistication with its childlike intimacy at times, too. So you have a combination, an irony, working back and forth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an American great, the writer Flannery O'Connor, and her youthful appeal to God to be someday somebody great, her appeal in prayer to be a writer who mattered. It's been recently discovered and brought out as a prayer journal by Flannery O'Connor. Its editor, W.A. Sessions, joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. Georgia, of course, her longtime home. Paul Eli is with us as well, writer, editor, and scholar of Flannery O'Connor, author of The Life You Save May Be Your Own, An American Pilgrimage, where he looks at Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day, Walker Percy, and Flannery O'Connor for modern American Catholics. There's a fascinating very early record of Flannery O'Connor when she was 5 or 6 in Georgia. She was said to have trained her pet chicken to walk backward, bringing the Petit Newsreel Company to document the stunt. Here's that old newsreel of a very young Flannery O'Connor.
Here's Mary O'Connor of Savannah, Georgia, holding the only chicken in the world that actually walks backwards. When she advances, she retreats. To go forward, she goes back. When she looks ahead, she's going astern. And when she arrives, she's really leaving.
Flannery O'Connor, Mary Flannery O'Connor, said that newsreel marked her forever. What an eye she brought to the world. Here's a little more for April 1959. Flannery O'Connor appearing at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, giving a reading of one of her most well-known short stories, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, which tells the story of a grandmother and her family accosted by a wanted criminal and killer called the Misfit. In this excerpt, Flannery O'Connor reading here, the grandmother appeals to the Misfit, offering God as a path to redemption.
If you would pray, the old lady said, Jesus would help you. That's right, the Misfit said. Well, then why don't you pray, she asked, trembling with delight suddenly. I don't need no help, he said. I'm doing all right by myself. No, lady, the Misfit said. I found out the crime don't matter. You can do one thing, you can do another. Kill a man or take a tire off his car. Because sooner or later, you're going to forget what it was you done and just be punished for it.
Flannery O'Connor reading from A Good Man Is Hard to Find in 1959 there at Vanderbilt University. Paul, right at the beginning of this collection, which Bill has brought out and put together, there's this wonderful, I mean, she addresses God right off the bat and directly. Dear God, I cannot love thee the way I want to. You are the slim crescent of a moon that I see, and myself is the earth's shadow that keeps me from seeing all the moon. She goes on to say, what I'm afraid of, dear God, is that my self-shadow will grow so large that it blocks the whole moon. Her ambitions are big in this journal, Paul. And at the same time, there's a fear that she'll blot out a faith that's important to her.
That's right. At the time, as far as I can tell, she hadn't fully assimilated a book that was going to be really important to her called Art and Scholasticism, you know, by Jacques Maritain. And Maritain, it's a complicated book, but his argument is that the best way for a Catholic artist to be a good Catholic is to be a good artist. When O'Connor read that, she took some of the burden off. She felt less obligated to be personally holy and to lose herself the way that we feel her trying to do in the journal. And she settled into being Flannery O'Connor, the person she was, and to devote herself to being a good artist and serve God that way.
You've got another entry, I think, there, Paul, where she talks about being an artist. This one was from, middle of April, 1947. She says, I must write down that I am to be an artist. She stakes that claim in her journal.
It's really striking, and when I read it, of course the O'Connor voice is here, but it reminds me of something out of one of the notebooks of Rilke or out of the early journals of Sylvia Plath, mm-hmm. this powerful youth with powerful self-determination and utter confidence that if she pursues this, she will wind up an artist. I must write down that I am to be an artist, not in the sense of aesthetic frippery, but in the sense of aesthetic craftsmanship. Otherwise, I'll feel my loneliness continually, like this, today. The word craftsmanship takes care of the work angle, and the word aesthetic, the truth angle. Angle. It will be a life struggle with no consummation. When something is finished, it cannot be possessed. Nothing can be possessed but the struggle. All our lives are consumed in possessing struggle, but only when the struggle is cherished and directed to a final consummation outside of this life is it of any value. I want to be the best artist it is possible for me to be under God. I do not want to be lonely all my life, but people only make us lonelier by reminding us of God. Dear God, please help me to be an artist. Please let it lead to you.
Paul Eli, reading there from Flannery O'Connor's A Prayer Journal. Bill Sessions edited that journal. To be a great artist, the best artist it's possible for her to be. Did she take license in that, Bill? I mean, did she, as Paul says, you know, be a great artist and maybe that's enough. Maybe that was the path that she saw as a path of faith. Or did she not later when her view got darker?
I don't think her view got darker. I think her view stayed the same. There's a wonderful passage on the beginning of January of 1947 that she wrote. It is very clear that what she writes there is something she followed always, which is that there is always a struggle, and the struggle is always between a self that wants to be united with God and everything else around it. But involved in that is also writing, and writing is a record. She just said that in what Paul read. It's mm-hmm. a struggle. This is a marvelous passage, I think. For me, it's the strangest one in the whole journal. It's like an oracle almost, or something that a desert father like Pseudo-Macarius or someone might have said. But it's a wonderful passage. No one can be an atheist who does not know all things. Only God is an atheist. The devil is the greatest believer, and he has his reasons. And the devil stayed with her in all of her work, but modulated or made into fiction. And I think that's the key thing, is that Flannery O'Connor wrote fiction. She did not write theology.
She writes very early in this prayer journal. She says, speaking directly to the Almighty here, she says, I want very much to succeed in the world with what I want to do. I have prayed to you about this with my mind and my nerves on it and strung my nerves into a tension over it and said, oh, God, please, and I must, and please, please. It's just remarkable, Bill, to see her kind of on her knees saying, let me amount to something.
Oh, no, I think it's very – Flannery O'Connor is very ambitious, and I don't think you can deny that. And that's what I like about the Farrar-Straus Giroux book, is that they have at the beginning a picture of her in the snow, and it's not an emaciated O'Connor. It's one who's out there in the snow. She has looks like a Georgia Bulldog shirt on. I'm not quite sure what. But in any case, she's active. She's alive. And this is part of being alive, is the praying and what goes with it. And that is, I think, what what she's asking for. The other side is, if you seems to me there are two things she asks for, to be a writer, and then the second thing is to join in the suffering of God or in some ways. And so she talks about pain throughout, and she's very much aware of that, that she needs to be more aware. But if she's not someone who's cloistered or who may feel in a very negative way about something, not at all. And so, but this is part of what goes on. And I say in my introduction that in very shortly, that is, she's 21, at 25, she comes down with lupus. And as I say in the introduction, her prayers were answered. She became a very good writer, and at the same time, she found a way of joining into the suffering of God at whatever. These passages are all filled with a sense of entry, a sense of being alive, a sense of joining in with something alive. And it's, as anyone knows who reads her stories, it's the negative that often makes the story so alive and so full, as the misfit certainly tells us.
Flannery O'Connor, yes, who would die at 39 of lupus, with a great body of work behind her. Her father, of course, had died of lupus when she was 15. Bill Sessions, W.A. Sessions, as editor, knew a prayer journal by Flannery O'Connor from when she was 20, 21, 22 years old. Bill, Paul, Eli, plenty of listeners for us here calling in. Phyllis in Brookfield, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Phyllis, what do you think?
Hi, Tom. Well, I read the excerpts of this journal in the New Yorker magazine several months ago and was so enthusiastic about it and couldn't wait to get the whole picture, because her voice, her crystal and clear voice with Christ-centering, is such a help to anyone trying to find their way. And it she became so vulnerable to me and endearing, which was different than any other focus I'd ever had of her. And her focus on faith and hope were beautiful. And I can't wait to get a hold of it. I'm so thankful to you gentlemen for reviving this and for finding this for us, because the dark side of Flannery was always intriguing, especially her short story, The Displaced Person, was just a crystalline experience, if you haven't read that one. But anyway, I want to thank you for your efforts, and she is such a special writer, and I'm so grateful that we have a chance to see this side of her.
It really is something to see, Phyllis. I appreciate your call. We'll look at that. And one more right here. Carmen in Nashville, Tennessee. Carmen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the observation that indeed what she prayed in a very personal and intimate way is at no small level being answered today in your show by the publishing of the journal, by the very public discussion of it. You all are participating in what she, I think, would view as an answer to her prayer to be not only a great writer, but remembered for being so.
I think she rang that bell a long time before we got here today. But, Carmen, what about her perspective on faith and how you read it changing through the years?
Well, I think that in the culture that we live in today, maybe the most profound thing that Flannery O'Connor continues to boldly declare is this very personal nature of the universe. She clearly believes in the personal reality of God and feels comfortable asking him, addressing him quite personally for very personal things. And I think that in our culture, that is a lesson that speaks loudly to a world that has in many ways lost touch with the personal nature of the universe. So I would say that's one part. I really appreciate the depth of her faith, which is articulated in irony and paradox and darkness. She's not afraid to point to the darkness because she is very aware of the light.
Carmen, thank you so much for your call. Paul, what stayed constant in Flannery O'Connor's kind of cosmology, and what changed as she stepped deeper into maturity as a writer?
Well, she spoke of the tension between the attraction to the holy and the disbelief in it as characterizing the life of her time half a century ago now. What we feel in this book so vulnerably, as one of the callers pointed out, is the attraction for the holy that Flannery O'Connor herself felt. When we encountered her work later, the attraction to the holy comes with irony, with sarcasm, with humor, with imagery of the grotesque, with violence, and we don't get it straight the way we do in this journal. That's not to say that it's preferable straight. I prefer the more complex expression of the attraction to the holy that we get in later O'Connor, but it certainly fills in the picture to see it straight and pure here in this journal.
Bill, you don't feel much of the grotesque here, which we just heard her talking about herself later, and she's well known for later. Is that here anyway? Is she just not got the sort of writerly muscle to bring it out yet? Is it just waiting to emerge? How do you read that, Bill?
Well, I think you have to remember Flannery O'Connor was a fiction writer, and you have to tell a story, and a story means that you're going to have a kind of dialectic between one thing and another, and you're certainly, if you're interested in what she wants to get at, you're going to get it the negative. She says very clearly, as Paul knows in things he's quoted, that the negative leads to the positive or can lead to the positive. She has an interesting phrase here in the beginning, the very first one that I always was struck by. As you know, the journal begins in the middle of things because mm-hmm. she tore out much of it and she was her own editor. But it has one wonderful line here. Please help me to get down under things and find where you are. Strikes me as a very good description of her fiction. You find characters like Ruby Turpin, O.J. Parker, or the misfit, or the little girl in Temple of the Holy Ghost, to get under things. It is the negative, the hidden, the strange, the bizarre, and to find God is there as well. That is, includes... In this, she was highly influenced, I think, by the French, like Bernanos, Mauriac, Peggy, and the others, which she was reading, by the way, at the same time. And I might add, as you know, I think I say that somewhere here, mm-hmm. that in the middle of this writing this journal in November of 1946, she began Wise Blood. She began Wise Blood in the Thanksgiving break of 1946. And after that... There are no more journals. There are journals before this, I might add. This is not they're not as elaborate, but they are journals. But after that, it moves on that is, everything that is in the journal has been objectified, it's been made into fiction, and has been made alive in another way.
Do you think she would be happy to have this journal from her youth out in front of everyone now? One of our callers was saying... You know, maybe this is the culmination of her desire. Do you think so, Bill? Or was it intended to be private?
I'm asked that question from the beginning. Is this too intimate to get out and so forth? Well, her letters are out, of course. I don't know that mm-hmm. that's the answer. But I know that she tried to save it and wanted it, and we know she made a facsimile, and she was very ambitious as a writer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an American great, the writer Flannery O'Connor, and her youthful appeal to God to be somebody, her appeal in prayer to be a writer who mattered. A journal written when she was 21 years old, now published, a prayer journal by Flannery O'Connor. Its editor, W.A. Sessions, Bill Sessions, is with us from Atlanta, Georgia today. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.com. Paul Eli is with us as well from New York, writer, editor, scholar of Flannery O'Connor. Carlene Bauer joins us in just a moment here. Let me read just a little more from her prayers and thoughts. It's almost Flannery O'Connor is theologian here, theologian slash artist slash love advisor. Here's an entry from her prayer journal. She writes, Freud, Proust, Lawrence have located love inside the human. There's no need to question their location. However, there is no need either to define love as they do, only as desire, since this precludes divine love, which, while it too may be desire, is a different kind of desire, divine desire, and is outside of man and capable of lifting him up to itself. Man's desire for God, she writes as a young woman here, is bedded in his unconscious and seeks to satisfy itself in physical possession of another human. She goes on to write, this necessarily is a passing, fading attachment in its sensuous aspects, since it is a poor substitute for what the unconscious is after. Young woman wrestling with all that and more in a prayer journal, just out, just rediscovered and published by Flannery O'Connor. Bill Sessions, Paul Eli, please stand by. Carlene Bauer joins us right now from New York, writer and journalist. Her novel, Francis and Bernard, just came out earlier this year, was inspired by, kind of takes off on the lives of Flannery O'Connor. Robert Lowell imagines a love affair between them. Her memoir is not that kind of girl. She's reviewed Flannery O'Connor's A Prayer Journal. You'll read that in Virginia Quarterly Review. Carlene Bauer, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
You've thought so much about Flannery O'Connor. I enjoyed Francis and Bernard
a
lot. And now here she is, Flannery O'Connor, in her own words, revealed at that age. That must have been something for you to read this directly, what you had kind of imagined in your work of fiction.
Yes. I find that one of the things I've been thinking about O'Connor for a while, there's a line in her letters where she says, my type of spirituality is almost completely shut mouth. And in the letters, you don't see a lot of want expressed, spiritual want, romantic want, any kind of want, really. And I'd often thought, what did she privately feel like she wanted from God? It's not articulated. It is, but it's sort of buried and circumspect. But to see this journal appear in which it's all about her want, and she's naked.
Oh God,
in her
please,
want,
I must, please, please.
Which you would never imagine if you read O'Connor, you'd think, well, we'll never hear anything like that. And she probably never spoke or even thought like that. But here she is. And one of the other things I think that's going on here that's so interesting for me, having been religious, is that one of the other things that comes up in the letters is a real campaign against piety, as it's written. She really is allergic to prayers written by other people. She says that, you know, you're stuck with other people's emotions and you can't live up to them. Or she says, you know, I hate having to say some of these prayers written by saints in an emotional state. You can, you know, it's like borrowed finery. And what's astonishing, one of the many astonishing things here is you see her trying to articulate her own form of prayer for herself. And that is, that again, is astonishing. And it sounds like no one else's. And it doesn't even sound like prayers that I think you're taught in church or that we would actually have in the Christian vernacular.
Well, around the edges, certainly, dear God, please send me your grace. But there is also a very original boldness right in the heart of this. I mean, this is a very bold address.
Yes. And I actually think one of the other things I was thinking while reading the journal is that I don't think that we're taught, if we're religious, that we're taught to be that bold with God. I think it is sort of encouraged, but I feel like sometimes it's lip service. But here we see someone not being afraid to ask God for what she wants, and also not being afraid to ask God to make her an artist. And I think also as an artist, you are discouraged from making that want public. You're not supposed to say that out loud, that you want to be great. You're supposed to keep that to yourself and just put your head down and work. And so to see someone, of course, she is great. She's a genius. So, it's, you know, she gets a pass. But I do think that's also liberating for artists in general, too.
She writes, the intellectual and artistic delights God gives us are visions. And like visions, we pay for them. And the thirst for the vision doesn't necessarily carry with it a thirst for the attendant suffering. Paul Eli, yes, as you write, the suffering would come. Paul, she writes in here at one point, she says, I am afraid of insidious hands, O Lord, which grope into the darkness of my soul. What's she talking about there, Paul?
It's hard to tell. I think at this point in her life, she was preoccupied with purity. She said that was her favorite among the virtues somewhere in her letters. And we see all through the journal this fear that she has that being an artist is somehow impure, and that the desire to be a fine writer is something impure, that she shouldn't want this. And as satisfying as the journal is as a new work of O'Connor's, it's important to note that she moved beyond that position and came to see that it was her calling to be a fine artist and that she didn't have to feel guilty about it. She had to get down to being the best Christian and Catholic artist that she could be and not fret too much about the impurity of doing her fictional business.
Bill Sessions, you knew her as a friend. Did she or would she have revealed that she'd actually prayed for greatness as a writer, or would she have found that too naked and personal face-to-face?
Well, I knew her when she was about 30, and when I first met her. Actually, she's 31, 1956. And she was, first of all, her voice was deeper than the records are giving here. Mm-hmm. And she had a very modulated voice. And we sat on that front porch at Andalusia and had lots of conversations. It was something, of course, that I recall now. I have to say quickly that the biography I didn't come to till about a decade ago. So I didn't go around like Boswell taking notes and checking out things.
Right.
And I run across letters all the time. I knew Walker Percy. Another day I found a whole back cache of letters from Walker. So, I mean, these are things that I haven't worked at. But I would say that the main thing that you find is that she certainly was aware that she wanted to be a very good writer. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, she was very ambitious on that. But she knew she had vocations, and one of them was for herself. She's always saying, at least she does to Betty Hester in some of the letters, well, I've got to level some levels of purgatory I've got to work out, or something to that effect. But I think Paul's on the right angle here in saying that the important thing is that she turned to her work, and that is to fiction. She's a fiction writer, and that's, in a sense, where we start, and that's what's going to last. This is a wonderful way, I think, this journal was, and that's what I discovered, why I wanted to get it out, to give us what Ms. Bauer is talking about, which is this whole sense of a human being talking, dealing with things, and not just fictionalizing him or objectifying him. In other words, her feelings were there all the time, and she certainly had them, I can tell you, and from conversations and letters and everything else. Her life was a remarkable life. It really was. And it's just no surprise for me, although I must say the trajectory of the prayer journal has really surprised me, and I think will. But it really has crossed barriers and crossed ideological barriers. And I particularly was pleased in The New Yorker when what they did was to have Dear God, Dear God, Dear God, Dear God. I think that's the crucial thing that's in this journal. It's obviously Christian. It obviously has a Catholic background, except for references to a novena she went to, which is Our Lady of Perpetual Help, which she refers to there. And the name of Christ, the name of Jesus, is not that much. It's there without any question. But it's the totality that she's trying to reach for. And that's what I think all good fiction writers should have, is totality.
We've got listeners writing in online, kind of looking at this from different angles. Here's one. Chris says, faith is the lens we use to bring focus to the world. Catholicism is essential to O'Connor's work, like Graham Greene's. But then we've got ex-Christian who writes, looking for love in all the wrong places. This document, full of rapturous self-pity, abjection, abnegation, records all that's wrong with religion. What do you think, Paul, when you hear those? On the one hand, yes, it informs everything she writes. On the other hand, you've got listeners saying, oh, don't go there, Flannery, wrong path.
Well, I think she figured out that she wasn't going to be a mystic, and to some extent, this journal is the journal of a person who wants to be a mystic, who wants to know God through some sort of personal encounter. She figured it out that her way to her best path was to dramatize the experience and not to seek it personally. Mm-hmm. And she dramatized it in such a way that characters like Hazel Motes, give voice to the anti-religious feeling that the correspondent wrote online. She was able to incorporate that into her vision.
There was that effort, though, that you can feel here to try, maybe, Carlene, to hit that mystic. I mean, someone wrote that, maybe it was you, Carlene, there's almost that the Hilda of Bingen or that medieval kind of effort to go for the oneness, to try it right here, try it out, see if it would work.
Well, I do think what goes on in the journal, which is also what goes on in the work, is while she yearned for mystery, as she said, she was also insistent throughout her work and in her life on rendering the concrete while one tries. She thought that to get to the divine in your fiction, you had to sort of render it through the concrete. You had to make the world believable. And I think that what goes on in the journal is she mentions things like she talks about, like, maybe while I'm thinking about something like floor wax and pigeon eggs, a prayer will come to me. So that, to me, is a very honest acknowledgement of the world that we live in. Like, even though we may be seeking faith and seeking the divine, we still have to go to grocery stores. We still have to make our beds. We still have to go to work. And I think that that is what maybe will make this prayer journal, why people are responding it so, is that she never discounts the earth that we live on. And I think that's also what maybe people respond to in the fiction and in the letters.
She writes, "Oh God, please make my mind clear. Please make it clean. Just as says, I do not know you, God, because I'm in the way. Please help me to push myself aside." Interesting question for a writer who will loom very large. Joshua in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'm just calling. I'm sort of thrilled, as everyone else is, with the release of this journal. I started a press actually this year called Wise Blood Books, which is named after Flannery O'Connor's first novel. And as someone who's sort of trying to make a living, not necessarily writing, but supporting writers, I've always been attentive to Flannery O'Connor's own comments on money and writing. She says that, you know, of Henry James, she says she can think of no writer who's hotter after the dollar than James, but also no one who is more conscientious as an artist. And I think it's interesting to me that oftentimes we see this sort of, you know, you don't think of an engineer asking himself, you know, should I try to, is it bad for me to succeed as an engineer and can I still be a Christian or something like that? Or a chemist saying, you know, can I really be a good chemist and be a successful chemist and still be a good Christian? I'm wondering, you know, if your guests have anything to say about why is it with the arts in particular that people tend to kind of really have these qualms of conscience, either artists or people who are kind of coming down on artists.
Paul, Eli, what would you say to Joshua's question?
I once heard from the artist Laurie Anderson that the reason art is so hard is that you're always making something out of nothing. And that's, in some respects, what an artist does. So I think society tends to focus on the nothing. You know, this person sitting at a desk making something out of nothing, where's the value in that? Where's the productivity? How does that enhance our economy and so forth? But the caller is absolutely right that why should the artist feel an obligation to get his or herself altogether out of the way? O'Connor, later in life, expressed it in terms of paradox. She felt that she never felt the loss of the self so much as when she was writing a short story, and yet the short story was a place where she could write with her whole personality. So not one or the other, but a loss of self and fullness of self combined there.
Carlene, you've got her last entry for us. If you dive right into it, we just have time to hear it. The last entry from her prayer journal.
So this is on September 26, 1947. My thoughts are so far away from God. He might as well not have made me. And the feeling I egg up writing here lasts approximately a half hour and seems a sham. I don't want any of this artificial, superficial feeling stimulated by the choir. Today I have proved myself a glutton for scotch oatmeal cookies and erotic thought. There is nothing left to say of me.
And off she goes into her great career. What do you make of that last entry, Carlene?
I think, again, like what I was talking about before with the sort of the combination of mysticism and the concrete, I think that that last line, I've seen a lot of writer friends of mine, I don't know where they stand in belief, but a lot of them have fixated on that line. And I think it's for several reasons. And I think one is because as an artist, no matter what you believe, you spend a lot of time sort of, you know, what Paul was saying, making something out of nothing, a lot of nothing. And you can feel that since you're not digging ditches, you're worthless. And I think that line sort of, who knows what she was sitting around doing all day, probably sitting at her typewriter, staring and eating scotch oatmeal cookies and thinking who knows what. But that admission that, and there is nothing left, that's all that was accomplished that day. And that admission, I think, is powerful and comforting. And I think also, if one is a believer, to know, and she sort of talks about this in her letters a lot, like, you know, she, anyway, but I think it's just comforting.
A great youthful candor in this prayer journal. Carlene Bauer has an imagined version of this young life in Francis and Bernard, wonderful novel. Carlene, thank you for being with us from New York today.
Thank you.
Paul Eli, author of The Life You Save May Be Your Own. Paul, thanks for your insights on Flannery O'Connor today.
Glad to deliver them. I'll be reviewing the book for The New Republic, and I blog at everythingthatrises.com.
Wonderful. We will read with great interest. And Bill Sessions, W.A. Sessions, editor of A Prayer Journal by Flannery O'Connor. Thank you so much, Bill, for all your insights and memories of Flannery herself today. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.